Good afternoon. We call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, January 31st, 2022, and the time is 1:15 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Members present today are Senator Stedman, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski was here on time, and he's coming back this way. Senator Von Imhoff is listening remotely. And Senator Hoffman is, I believe, as well, listening remotely. So, with that being said, today's agenda, HB 41, Shellfish Projects, Hatcheries, and Fees. And next up will be HB 85, Financial Institutions and Liability. HB 41, Shellfish Projects, Hatcheries, and Fees. This is the first hearing for HB 41 this session. However, we heard this bill twice last session. We adopted a Senate Finance CS, which is now before the committee. Our intention is to hear a quick reintroduction of the bill, cover fiscal notes, and look to the will of committee. Representative Ortiz, if you'd like to join us at the table, and whoever else you got here with you, looks like you're the Lone Ranger.
Lone Ranger today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you'd put yourself on the record for the committee and those listening at home, give us a quick reintroduction, and I believe there might be a question or two you want to put on the record, too, to answer some.
For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent Southern Southeast Alaska, District 36, and yes, thank you for the opportunity to bring before this committee again House Bill 41. Just as a quick overview of the bill, Mr. Chairman, it's an enhancement of Alaska's, it's a shellfish enhancement bill, and basically the idea here is mariculture, big opportunity for Alaska to expand its fishing industry economy. We've been aware of this over the last 7 or 8 years, but there's certain things that have to be put into place to expedite or at least to push forward the whole mariculture industry, and House Bill 41 is a piece of that puzzle. This bill allows qualified nonprofits to pursue enhancement and or restoration projects involving shellfish species, including red and blue king crab, sea cucumber, abalone, and razor clams. The bill creates a regulatory framework with which the Department of Fish and Game can manage shellfish enhancement projects and outlines criteria for issuance of permits. It sets out stringent safety standards to ensure sustainability and health of existing natural stocks, and the commissioner of the director of commercial fish is online to answer any questions and is available for his testimony. And with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there's questions from the committee, I'm happy to give up the mic and put forward this bill for your guys' consideration.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? And we do have Sam Raybung, Director of ComFish, Nicole Reynolds, John Hagee from ComFish Entry Commission, and also we have the Executive Director of Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission here in Juneau. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ortiz, is there anybody opposed to this bill? Is there anybody opposed to this bill?
To my knowledge, there's a few people out there. There's been some longstanding critics over the years. This bill has been around. It's been very well vetted. You know, I think your office is probably aware of maybe some recent emails that came from some folks from the state, but basically I think the concerns that have been raised are, you know, it's nothing new, and we've answered these questions in the past. However, if you or any member of this committee has lingering questions, Mr. Raybung is online to address those particular issues, and I just feel like this bill, very well vetted, very well understood, and I'm hoping that this.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, are there any subsistence groups that, more specifically, are there any subsistence groups that are opposed to this bill?
Not to my knowledge.
Thank you. No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It'd be nice to hear from the department and see what their position is on the bill.
Mr. Raybong, Director of Comfish, Fish and Game, did you hear Senator Stedman's question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did. For the record, my name is Sam Raybong. I'm the Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I have not heard whether or not the governor has said that we support this bill yet this year. We've been in front of you, probably 6 years or more now, talking about this bill. What I will say is that the governor's Mariculture Task Force has identified this as one of the top five priorities to move mariculture forward in the state of Alaska, and the governor has publicly stated that he wishes to make Alaska the mariculture capital of the world.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's for the director. Is there any opposition to this bill among fish and game scientists or biologists?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. You know, I would say that scientists and biologists have personal opinions, and all of us have concerns about any time we work with wild organisms and want to make sure that we're doing things safely. I believe the safeguards that we have built into this program and the ability to be flexible in those safeguards takes care of most of those concerns. There's always going to be a little bit of fear of the unknown, but I will say that we have employed some of the highest standards, or probably the highest standards of anywhere in the world when it comes to enhancement or culture of organisms.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Is it possible to get copies of the opposition from the scientists or biologists at Fish and Game? So I can weigh that in determining how I'm going to vote.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I actually don't have anything in writing. It's just we have continual and constant conversations about things like this whenever they come up. So I don't have anything like that available. It's just one of those things that we always want to take into account all concerns, and those are built into our permitting process, if you'll indulge me. Our existing permitting process is a model of how we would proceed should this bill pass. And we hear from all many segments of our department, so from our geneticists, our pathologists, our management biologists, our research biologists, both from Comfish and Sportfish and Subsistence. Anybody who would have this kind of work might overlap in their area, and we ask them to weigh a proposal, a potential permit, and provide input. And in the case of any concerns, if they have any proposed modifications or stipulations, that we would apply to the permit to alleviate those. And we aren't afraid to say no. We oftentimes deny permits, probably more than are approved in the long run. So I guess short story long, I don't have written opposition from any staff members to any of this work or any of this proposed work. And were we to go forward, any concerns or any professional areas of concern would be addressed in the permitting process.
Senator Wilikowski, follow-up?
Would the department be willing to make those scientists or biologists who have expressed concerns available to members of the legislature to discuss those concerns or before this committee? Yes?
I apologize. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I certainly don't have any concerns about having any of the commercial fisheries staff available to answer your questions.
Okay. I'll get with you. I don't want to out anyone. I just want to find out what the concerns are before I vote on the bill.
Senator Olson.
On that point, Mr. Raybong, would you characterize the discussion that's gone back and forth as something as an ongoing type of discussion that's happening as opposed to outright opposition to this particular bill?
Senator Olson, through the chair. Yes, that's exactly how I would characterize it. And whether this bill passes or not, we will continue to have those conversations regarding the things that we do permit. It's just how we operate. There's always new information coming up through novel research and through experience gained from existing projects and activities, and so we're always reevaluating. And I guess I would say that none of our guidance is static. We're always trying to learn more. We have ongoing large-scale research projects in place to, you know, verify that our safeguards are actually working the way we think they are, and we will continue to do those things as funding is available, of course.
Thank you, Senator Olson. No further questions. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I think we're working on version G of the bill. I'm looking at page 5, lines 4 through 6. It talks about releasing shellfish in an area where shellfish will be available to traditional fisheries. And I'm curious how that is defined, traditional fisheries.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. So these are enhancement projects are intended to benefit existing common property fisheries. So the intention is that they will be harvested in fisheries that already exist.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
When you say fisheries already exist, can you define that a little bit better for me? Is that fisheries where people are allowed to fish commercially, subsistence-wise, sport fish-wise? How is that defined?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, all of the above. Common property fisheries entail all of those fisheries. So if a enhancement project releases in an area that has any one or all of those fisheries already in existence in their area, they will have access to the resultant organisms, regardless of their fishery, as long as it's, you know, already, you know, we already have a, let's use red king crab for example. So we already have a commercial red king crab, personal use, sport, and subsistence red king crab fishery in Southeast Alaska. In that area, they would have access to any red king crab produced by an enhancement project and released in that area.
Thank you.
Okay. Brief it is. Back on the record. Any further questions? Seeing none.
Chair, just one.
Senator Wilikowski.
Just on the funding, is there funding for this bill? Is there?
I'm going to cover the fiscal notes, okay. Senator.
Thank you.
They're all zero, but I'll cover the fiscal notes in detail. Follow-up?
I guess just in light of that, I'm just curious how the administration intends to fund this if there's zero fiscal notes.
I believe when I read the backup on the fiscal notes, it should answer your question, sir.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson, are you ready to move the bill?
Addies?
Now we're going to cover the fiscal notes, but you're ready to move the bill, though. Okay. I'm just checking. All right. The first fiscal note is Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Appropriation is to Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Allocation to the same.
OMB component number is 393. It's a zero fiscal note. If you'll go to the analyses on the second page, HB 41 amends AS 1651 to provide additional powers to ASME, Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, and allow the board to market aquatic farm products in addition to commercially harvested seafood from Alaska's waters. It also permits ASME to market mariculture projects using existing fund sources or by seeking new grant funding, but does not expand their assessment to include aquatic farms or include our alternate funding sources to marketing activities.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I believe that when we adopted to version G, it changed that, and so that's no longer an option. That the difference between version I and version G was it removed the promotion of aquatic farm products from the purview of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
Okay. So you want to cover the rest of the fiscal notes? Because you've got an updated one.
No, sir. I think that was the change, and I don't think the notes were updated to with
okay.
that.
Thank you. Why don't you take an at ease and break past that to me? We're back on the record, so Senator Wilson is correct. So this fiscal note 393 is no longer relevant. The second one, Department of Fish and Game, I was doing a hell of a job there, too, for a minute. Department of Fisheries, Fish and Game, Comfish, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, OMB component number 471. That is a zero fiscal note. But in the analysis, this would create a new chapter in Title 16 allowing for the creation of shellfish enhancement projects similar to salmon hatcheries. If enacted, the Commissioner of Fish and Game could use permits to nonprofit corporations seeking to engage in shellfish enhancement activities. I want to reemphasize that. This is for shellfish enhancement activities. Okay, the Limited Entry Act would further be amended to provide that those holding special area permits for shellfish could employ gear designated as legal by the Board of Fisheries, and Commercial Entry Commission does not anticipate any additional fiscal impact. Zero fiscal note. Third one, well, it'll be the second one now. Department of Fish and Game, Comfish, allocation to Comfish, OMB component 2965, that's zero. This bill, under the analysis, the Commercial Fisheries Division intends to utilize the existing staff under the aquaculture section to administer this program and propose legislation, the permit application fee for shellfish enhancement projects, and new salmon private nonprofit hatcheries will be removed from statute. However, the division that estimates that there will be 2 to 3 applications per year in the first 2 years, and subsequently there will be a decline to an estimated of 1 application per year going forward. Special appropriations under shared taxes, salmon enhancement tax, OMB component number 3251, that's zero fiscal note. This appropriation will be reflected in the language section of the operating budget under the shared taxes section. The salmon enhancement tax allocation was used for the fiscal note for informational purposes because the fiscal note system does not allow for the creation of new allocations. If enacted, this appropriation would be made in a new shellfish enhancement program. Last one, I believe, is Department of Treasury, Taxation and Treasury Tax Division, OMB component number 2476. Again, that is zero. And this bill on the revenue impact previously at the bottom of the page, the department is in the process of setting a rate by regulation for another fishery for calendar years 22 based on this projection by the Department of Fish and Game, two or three applications per year. The revenue impact of this proposed legislation is expected to be minimal. All revenue would be considered other restricted, as it is intended for appropriation back to that hatchery permit holder. The implementation cost, this will not require the department to make material changes to the tax revenue management system. Therefore, there'd be no cost to the department for this implementation, and there will be a small additional administrative burden on the tax division, though. That covers the fiscal notes. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to move Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 41, Finance, 32-LS0291, version G from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Any objections to moving the bill? Seeing none, so moved. We'll sign the document as we roll around the table and bring up our next presenter. Thank you, Rep. Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate it very much.
Yep.
I'll send you a bill.
Yeah. Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, you want to bring yourself and whoever, that trusty aide there, Mr. Burns. Welcome to Senate Finance, Representative LeBron. Today we have HB 85, Financial Institutions Liability. This is the first hearing for HB 85. Our intention at this committee is to hear the bill, introduction and sectional analyses, then take invited and public testimony and set the bill aside. We all know Representative LeBron, Mr. Burns. Please put yourselves on the record, and we will listen to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of Senate Finance Committee. I'm Representative Bart LeBon. I represent downtown Fairbanks House District 1. With me is my Chief of Staff, Joe Burns. I will do a brief summary of the bill, House Bill 85, and then with your pleasure, Mr. Chairman, Joe Burns could cover the sectional analysis. As you've just mentioned, we have some invited guests on the line. We have several bankers and representatives of the Division of Banking and Division of Environmental Conservation. So we do have some lifelines available here as we present. In summary, House Bill 85 seeks to create parity and a level competitive field between national chartered and state chartered banks. In Alaska, there are three federal or nationally chartered banks. They are Wells Fargo, Key Bank, and First National Bank Alaska. There are three state chartered banks, that's Denali State Bank, North Rim Bank, and First Bank, and one mutual charter bank, Mount McKinley Bank, and that was my former place of employment. What House Bill 85 does is attempts to bring regulatory parity between the various types of banks that do business in Alaska. Banks chartered through the federal government are regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency under the Department of Treasury, and banks chartered through the state are regulated by the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Over time, what's happened here is nationally chartered banks have been given greater power by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and there's a competitive gap that has slowly formed. And what we're attempting to do here, and I might add with the support of the Alaska Bankers Association, all members are represented in the Alaska Bankers Association, is to create competitive parity between state chartered and national chartered banks. As mentioned earlier, we do have representatives of a state charter bank and a mutual bank, along with some support from Division of Banking and DEC. So with that, I don't want to get too deep into this because we have very good invited testimony online. So, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to go into sectional analysis, that will provide some insight as to what the bill does.
Thank you, Representative LeBron. Mr. Burns, are you the man for the sectional?
I am, Mr. Chair, and for the record, my name is Joe Burns, staff to Representative Bart LeBron. So the sectional starts, section one, starts on page one, line nine. So chapter five of Title VI is the Alaska Banking Code. This section details the powers of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. You'll find the actual change on page two, line three, which is just conforming language to changes that are going to be made in section 10 regarding the statutes governing the establishment of a new branch bank or changing the location of a branch bank, which I'll explain in greater detail when we get to that section. Section two starts on page two, lines, or line 14. This adds a new subsection to the powers of the department, prohibiting the department from adopting regulations on two things. First are limitations on a credit card that a state bank issues to an officer of a state bank, which connects to section five of the bill regarding lending to executive officers and regulation 3AC02.121, annulled in section 24. Second are regulations relating to the setting of time limits on the disposal of real and personal property, and this connects to section six of the bill and annulled regulations in section 24. Section three starts on page two, line 22, with a change starting on line 24. This section governs the publication of reports. It directs a bank to post statutorily required reports on the bank's website and makes it optional to post those reports in the bank's physical lobby. The requirement that a copy of the report of condition being supplied upon request at no charge remains unchanged. This also makes state law more consistent with federal regulations for nationally chartered banks, which do not have the requirement to post notices of publication of financial reports. Section 4 starts on page 3, line 9, with a change on line 13. This defines the time frame, not later than 15 days, for which a bank must notify the department after an emergency non-opening or closing of the bank. Section 5 starts on page 3, line 19. This increases the amount a director or executive officer of a state bank may borrow from their bank to $500,000, and this change aligns with the borrowing limit for nationally chartered banks. Section 6 starts on page 3, line 31, and continues to page 4, line 7. This is the disposition of property not needed in the conduct of banking business. This removes the department's authority to set a time limit on the disposal of real and personal property, and instead, the carrying value and write-down will be dictated by generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP, and this is consistent with federal regulations governing nationally chartered banks. Section 7 starts page 4, line 8, with the main change beginning on line 21. This change allows a state bank to pledge bank assets as collateral security to secure funds deposited by federally recognized tribes and consortiums of federally recognized tribes. Section 8 starts on page 4, line 27, and continues on to page 5. This adds a new subsection to replace the Division of Banking's Parity Orders 12-B regarding the pledging of assets for interest rate swaps. It also adds a subsection to define federally recognized tribe as an Indian tribe under the Federally Recognized Tribe List Act of 1994 and interest rate swap agreement as a stream of future interest payments that are exchanged for another stream of future interest payments. And this amendment achieves parity by authorizing state banks to pledge assets for interest rate swaps according to the same regulations as national banks. And I'll note that national banks are regulated by Section 610 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Section 9 starts page 5, line 12. This requires all banks to become member of the FDIC as a condition for receiving a certificate of authority. Presently, all banks in the state of Alaska are FDIC insured, and it is a requirement for all national chartered banks under federal regulation to be FDIC insured. Section 10 is a repeal and reenactment. It starts on page 5, line 17. This section governs changes of location for branch banks. This language provides state chartered banks parity with credit unions when establishing a bank branch. Banks are currently subject to stricter bank branch application requirements under regulation. The division would establish in regulation similar requirements as credit unions. And you'll notice that this language is again repeated in Section 19 for state chartered mutual banks. Section 11 starts on page 5, line 22. And this reduces the number required meetings of a bank's board from 10 to once quarterly. And this brings a level of parity with national chartered banks, which do not have a required number of board meetings. Section 12 starts page 5, line 26, with a change on line 31. This is conforming language to changes made under Section 10 to provide Alaska chartered banks parity with credit unions when establishing a bank branch. Section 13 starts on page 6, line 22. This is the definition section for the chapter, and this excludes remote service unit, which is like an ATM, from the definition of branch bank and defines remote service unit directly under this section. Section 14 starts on page 7, line 1. So chapter 15 of Title 6 governs mutual banks, and this language allows mutual banks to have similar borrowing options as state banks. This raises the amount that may be borrowed from a mutual bank to no more than 15% of assets unless the department approves a greater amount. And this is raised from the current 5% limit. Section 15 starts on page 7, line 6. This expands the deposits that mutual banks can accept beyond just savings deposits. And the Federal Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980 expanded the authority for nationally chartered mutual banks to accept deposits. And this amendment authorizes state mutual banks to accept the same deposits as national mutual banks. Section 16 starts on page 7, line 13. This allows trustees to delegate their authority to approve interest on deposits. Section 17 starts on page 7, line 18. This provides mutual banks with the same investment opportunities as state banks under ASO 605-270. Section 18 starts on page 7, line 26, and this provides mutual banks with the same lending opportunities again as state banks. Section 19 starts page 7, line 31, and continues to page 8. This regards changes of location for branch banks, and it provides mutual banks parity with state banks and credit unions when establishing a new bank branch, and this is the same language found in Section 10 for state banks. Section 20 starts on page 8, line 5. Title 43 of Alaska statutes, the Alaska Business License Act, found in Chapter 70. This language exempts depository institutions, so banks and credit unions, from the requirement to obtain business licenses for all headquarter and branch locations. Currently, state-chartered institutions receive a certificate of authority through the Division of Banking and Securities, and until each institution receives the certificate, they may not transact business. So this change would eliminate duplicate licensing and thus reducing that regulatory burden, and this change that came at the proposal of the Division of Banking and Securities. Section 21 starts on page 8, line 28, and this is a conforming language change, adding a reference to the new subsection O, which is being added in Section 22. Section 22 starts on page 9, line 31, and continues on from there. This conforms state law to the Federal Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, or CERCLA, standard for lender liability. So CERCLA contains a secured creditor exemption that eliminates owner or operator liability for lenders who hold ownership in a CERCLA facility primarily to protect their security interests in that facility, provided they do not participate in the management of the facility. Generally, participation in the management applies if a bank exercises decision-making control over a property's environmental compliance or exercises control at a level similar to a manager of the facility or property. The secured creditor exemption also provides that foreclosure on a property does not result in liability for a bank, provided the bank takes reasonable steps to divest itself of the property at the earliest practicable, commercially reasonable time on commercially reasonable terms. Generally, a bank can maintain business activities and close down operations at the property as long as the property is listed for sale shortly after the foreclosure date at the earliest practicable, commercially reasonable time. Section 23, or statute repealers, it begins on page 10, line 23. The first repeals AS 06-05-265 regarding liability of directors for certain loans. It also repeals AS 06-10, section 10 through 50. This is the Model Foreign Bank Loan Act. And that act exempted out-of-state banks from Alaska taxation for certain business types and became obsolete in 1984 due to other tax measures. It also repeals AS 06-15-150, 160, and section 170, which are surplus requirements, additions, and limitations. It also repeals AS 06-15-230 regarding withdrawal of deposits. Section 24, or annulled regulations, starts on page 10, line 25. Annuls Title III AAC-02-121, which is credit cards for officers. This relates back to sections 2 and 5. And annuls 3 AAC-02-135, which is the disposition of property not needed for banking business. And this relates back to sections 2 and 6. Section 25 starts on page 10, line 26. This sets the applicability of sections 3, 4, 6, 9, 10, 12, 16, 18, and 19 to apply on or after the effective date of this act, and cites the definition locations for branch bank, department, international bank, interstate bank, mutual bank, and state bank. Section 26 starts on page 11, line 31. Provides a transition period relating to sections 1, 10, 12, and 19, providing the department time to promulgate regulations for changes in bank branch locations and the establishment of branch banks. Section 27 is a delayed effective date. The first one was the transition. 27 is a delayed effective date, which sets a delayed effective date for sections 1, 10, 12, and 19. Giving the department time to promulgate those regulations. Section 28 is an immediate effective date, and it sets an immediate effective date for all sections except for 1, 10, 12, and 19. And that concludes the sectional analysis.
Questions on the sectional analysis? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is quite a meaty bill with a lot of technical terms, and just trying to get a little bit more explanation on Section 7 and Section 8. Can you explain more in layman terms what a Section 7 really does in terms of, so this allows an exemption for really recognized tribes, and what's the current process and why is this needed? And then Section 8, can you provide an example of when that might occur?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilson, we have also online Mr. Joel Shearhorn from North Rim Bank, and I would be willing and happy if he would like to take a stab at that first question about pledging bank assets as collateral, or I could take a stab, but I'm willing to invite expert testimony if the chair is so willing.
And we also have online Robert Schmidt, Director of Banking and Securities, David Durham, Alaska Bankers Association, Tracy Reno, And of course, Mr. Shearhorn, he's in the queue to testify first. So, Senator Wilson, who would you like to hear from?
We'll go with the recommendation from Representative, I guess.
If Mr. Shearhorn is willing to take that question, or I could take a stab at it, I'll give him first bite.
Why don't you take a stab at it, Representative LeBron, first, because then I know Joe's listening. Then when we get to the invited testimony, I don't want to bring him off and on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the short answer is banks are required by certain depositors to secure their deposits with assets of the bank. That's very common with local governments, cities, boroughs. If a depositor requires collateralization on the deposits, a bank needs to find assets that it owns to pledge to that depositor to secure their deposits from any risk of loss. It just expands the options for a state bank to secure those deposits to include federally recognized tribes. And so it just broadens the authority of a state bank to deal with federally recognized tribes in addition to local governments. And maybe I hope that's a long enough answer that satisfies that question.
Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's fine. And maybe Joe can add to that when it is up for public testimony. I guess the next part with that was, can you explain maybe where an example of Section 8 may occur?
Yes, through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilson. The amendment achieves parity by authorizing state banks to pledge assets for interest rate swaps. Now, if you're getting into the weeds on what an interest rate swap is, I don't know if that's the intent of the question, but all the state banks are looking for is equality and parity if they're engaged in that type of lending activity, which national banks have that privilege. State bank wants to be treated equally in that option, and that's what that section does. And I think maybe even the Division of Banking and Securities might have an opinion about how that works.
Mr. Schmidt, Director of Division of Banking and Securities, are you listening to the conversation?
Yes, I am.
And would you like to further comment on Representative LeBron's explanation to Senator Wilson?
Yes. The Section 8 relative to interest rate swaps would, as he indicated, allow state-chartered depository financial institutions to do what federally chartered financial institutions may do on interest rate swaps.
So we're getting back to parity, which you had talked about earlier, Representative LeBron. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. What's the historical rationale for having state chartered banks treat these interest swaps different than the national banks?
Yes, through the chair, Senator, I don't know if there was a rationale in doing so. National banking laws over time change and morph, whereas state banking law, unless somebody brings it forward like I am doing and asks for parity and changes in state statute to catch up with national banking law, the national banking laws are not going to adapt themselves to the state of Alaska's banking laws. There are 50 states that they would have to navigate that parity. It's up to each state to look at its own banking laws and regulations, and then when appropriate, like we are doing with House Bill 85, come before the legislature and make recommendations on improvement. Again, for the sake of parity and a level competitive playing field, that's the primary motivation of this bill.
Thank you. Any other? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative LeBond, since we've in several sections have talked about federally recognized tribes, have these put forth an opinion as to whether they like this bill or not?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Olson, I have not heard any opposition. Maybe the invited testimony from the two bankers might expand on that, but I've not been approached by any of the federally recognized tribes that would have any opposition to this. But I would think, quite contrary, they would be pleased with that change, because that opens another avenue for a banking relationship with a state chartered bank.
No further question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I think this might be directed toward the Director of Banking. It's regarding Section 14, and my understanding is that the current amount, aggregate amount of outstanding liabilities may not exceed 5%, and this is increasing it to 15%. Just curious how that 5% got into existence and what the rationale is. Are we at all worried about overextended banks by going to 15%?
Mr. Schmidt, did you hear Senator Wilikowski's question, and can you comment, or do you need it repeated?
Chairman, I did hear his comment. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, thank you for the question. First of all, as I indicated before, the federal banking laws have morphed and changed over time and granted federally chartered banks increased authority relative to state chartered banks, and Section 14 is another example of that, which is to say, again, we are allowing state chartered financial institutions to do what federally chartered financial institutions may do. More generally, to the root of the question relative to the stability of banks, I would note that the state banks are traditionally quite conservatively managed. That has been decades since a state chartered bank went out of business, and we are not concerned with the changes proposed in this bill, and we consistently see exemplary performance from our state chartered financial institutions. And I would specifically state that some state chartered banks have, in the current financial environment, done even better than I might have expected, given the challenges that they are facing.
Thank you. Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
To the director on Section 4, what are your thoughts? Do you have any concerns on this provision, which the current law says if in an emergency a bank may not elect to open its offices but has to notify the department of the non-opening as soon as possible, and in any event, as soon as possible is being added. It says not later than 15 days after the non-opening or closing, and this is changing it to as soon as possible. Do you have any thoughts on that? Does this make it quicker than 15 days, longer than 15 days?
Through the chair, it makes it a concrete, bright line. 15 days is much easier to understand than as soon as possible, and we do not have concerns relative to this change. I would also note that we have four state chartered banks, three state chartered banks, one state chartered mutual bank, and one state chartered credit union, and we have excellent routine communication with all five of those institutions.
Follow up?
Yeah, different section if I could for the director also. Section 22, this is on page 10, version W. It looks like it has it says a person who holds or held a security interest in a vessel or facility to secure a loan. So we're exempting a person. And how would you define a person? Is that this bill I thought was limited to banks, but is it broader than that?
Through the chair, it could include corporate entities, any person, whether it be a bank, a credit union, or another corporate entity that is holding property as collateral for a loan, so it could extend beyond banks or credit unions.
Follow up?
I would also note that the current, my understanding of the current CERCLA exemption is it includes the person language as presently found here, although I would need to defer to DEC for particulars on that.
Follow up, Senator Wilcox.
Is DEC on the line, Mr. Chairman?
DEC is on the line. Tiffany Larson, can you hear us?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski had a question. Did you hear the question or you need it repeated?
For the record, Tiffany Larson, Director, Division of Spill Prevention and Response. I heard the question. I believe it to be, why are we saying person in lieu of lender or institution? And that is simply to match the language in CERCLA and allow, have a broader applicability and not reduce that liability just being the lender. It is a person. And that goes back to joint and several liability, which is another component of CERCLA.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski?
My big concern with this section is the you have a situation, you have PFAS in people's water wells or some other hazardous substance, and I guess I'm worried about laundering liability, for lack of a more diplomatic term. Does DEC have any concerns about that? Because this is extremely broad. It allows another corporation or company to come in and maintain business activities involving the vessel or facility and not be liable. And that strikes me a little bit as being overbroad. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Absolutely, Senator, through the chair. That was one of our concerns initially as well. However, if the section 22O talks about that management of the property, the lender isn't able to manage the property in any way. And because of that, the lender has to simply act as a lender and foreclose on the property and then work expediently to divest itself of that property to avoid any liability. If the lender fails to do that or manages the property, they would then have liability. In addition to that, the joint and several liability remains on that property whether or not it was foreclosed on, which just means all the previous people that were responsible for contamination on a site remain responsible. All that this language does is exclude a lender and, in the state's view, allow a contaminated property the opportunity to get into the hands of someone or some business who's perhaps more solvent and can address that contamination.
Thank you for that answer. It's a little clearer for me. I had a note on section 21 as well, Senator Wilikowski. Senator Wilikowski, follow up?
Yeah, and can you just point me to, so, okay, company A owns a property that leaks a hazardous substance and damages an aquifer which serves a community. Company B has a security interest. They take over the property. Where's the legal obligation for company B to clean that up? They're a separate entity. They weren't operating previously. Is there a statute or regulation or something that says they are now obligated to clean up that property?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. So joint and several liability extends to essentially owner, operator, and contaminator. And so the liability would be for anyone that at any time from the point of contamination forward owned or operated or caused to be released a contaminant on a property. This exemption provides only for the lender and uses the person language from CERCLA as a matter of consistency between federal law, but provides only for the lender to have that exemption. So the lender is the only one who would not then be pulled into that umbrella of joint and severally liable for contamination on a property. So in your instance, business B, if they operated or managed that property in any way that was not expressly for the point of selling that property, they would then be liable, yes.
Senator Wilson?
Yeah, I have a question on that line of questioning, Mr. Chair, to Director Larson. For PFAS contamination, I don't think there's a mandatory regulation or statute that says you have to declare a PFAS contamination on property before you sell that, sell a parcel.
Well, okay, so let me try to frame your question a little, okay. So I can understand it, okay? And I'm looking at the bill sponsor at the other end of the table. To your question, Senator Wilson, PFAS contamination, the bank has loaned me money to buy it on my property, and I go defunct on my home loan. The bank, this is to make sure the bank, that it's like cradle to grave under CERCLA for the contamination is still going to stay with the originator of the contamination. And under PFAS, it'd be dependent upon where it's at, could be the state of Alaska, right? You know, following federal law for the firefighting foam. This is to hold the bank harmless on that loan that went defunct to that lender. Right, and you're not picking up the liability for the PFAS that migrated under that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I could weigh in, Representative Bartlebon, House District 1. The liability or responsibility, a responsible party could be more than just the owner or operator of the property. Many years ago, I had a loan on a gas station in the Fairbanks area, and a fuel delivery to said gas station accidentally overfilled the tank and spilled fuel around the tank on the site. So one could say, is the owner of that property responsible for that? Or is the lender, I had a loan on the property, am I responsible for that? Or is a fuel delivery company that overfilled the tank responsible for it? It goes back to responsible party, and, you know, the gas station owner dealt with it properly. The company dealt with it properly, but was the bank or even the property owner responsible? No, but they had knowledge, so they dealt with the knowledge and they worked to get it cleaned up appropriately. So maybe that's an answer, maybe it isn't, but that's a true life answer.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, if I could try to clarify my question then, Mr. Chair. For PFAS in particular, there is no requirements. And so what I heard Director Larson say is that a new buyer of that lot who may have taken out a new loan would also be responsible for contamination cleanup, even though there's no regulatory compliance issues to clarify or to disclose a contamination of PFAS. I just want to make sure that that's what I heard Director Larson say, that the new owner of a property of the contaminant would also be responsible for cleanup of that contaminant.
Director Larson, can you comment on Senator Wilson's questioning?
Yes, through the chair, that is correct. The new owner of the property would be responsible for remediating the contamination or addressing it. And that is actually the hope of this section, that contaminated properties are no longer, don't remain with facilities or individuals who are insolvent, and instead through foreclosure can get in the hands of somebody who knowingly is purchasing a contaminated site and is able to address that contamination.
And, Mr. Chair, if I...
Senator Wilson.
Then that's just my concern then, because there is no requirement to disclose, so there would not be a willingness to... I guess that's maybe something for another piece of legislation to have those disclosures, but I just see that as an issue as a state to make sure we do have some type of disclosure of contaminated sites.
I'm not for sure, but I think there might be some PFAS legislation circulating in the building. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not so much concerned about the banks who provide loans. They don't have any interest in doing this. I'm more concerned about companies setting up shell companies, for example, that do not participate in the management. And then once a property, and you can pretty easily see this happening with a potentially hazardous type of company, they set up a shell corp. The shell corp accidentally releases a whole bunch of hazardous substance, which damages a community, and then the corp that was not the shell corp, the main corporation, says, well, we're going to foreclose on that loan, that security interest, and take it over. They continue to maintain it. They maintain business activities. They try to sell it, but who wants to buy it at that point? I guess that's more my concern, and then they've escaped liability. That's my concern, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm wondering, could we maybe ease this by just changing a person to a bank, or you know, a mutual bank, for example?
That's a good question, and something we'll have to work through as we continue to hear this legislation. Senator, Representative Laban.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to point out, though, that individuals may hold secured interest in real estate, not just banks. So I think expanding the language to include an individual who might have a secured interest in a property, an owner's contract, if you will, I think they're looking for protection, too, under the liability of a environmental spill or contamination, not just a bank.
Thank you. Any further questions? We'll go to Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, some of the repealer sections, Mr. Chairman. There was one, and it's a little challenging when we don't have them in front of us, but it looks like Section 23, ASO 605265, talked about liability for certain loans, and just curious if we could get a little more definition on that.
Mr. Burns, or Representative Laban.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And directors have responsibility for the operation of their banks, and this just defines how that liability is extended to the director. And again, I might invite Mr. Joe Shearhorn to weigh in on this. Thank you.
Joe, I hope you're keeping track of all these questions. If not, we'll get them repeated to you. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if my question's for Mr. Smith or maybe Director Chambers online, but it goes with Section 20. This section exempts depository institutions from requiring to obtain a business license for all headquarter and branch locations. Just wondering of how many locations are we talking about in the state? And what type of reductions in state revenues might that add up to?
Ms. Chambers, did you hear that question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. This is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And through the chair, we estimate there are approximately 50 business licenses that would be foregone with this legislation. There are approximately five primary corporations with many branches. Each branch is required to get a business license. However, the cost of the business license is it's so minimal that the annual loss of revenue to the state would be less than $1,500. Currently, there is no cost for a business license. The governor has waived that cost for the time being. So anywhere from $0 to $1,500 would be the annual loss to the state.
Thank you. Further questions, committee members, before we go to invited testimony? Seeing none, we're going to go to our first invited testimony, Mr. Joe Shearhorn, formerly from Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Stedman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. This is Joe Shearhorn. I'm the Chairman, President, and CEO of North Rim Bank. Well, first off, Mr. Chair, am I coming through okay?
Yes, you are, Joe. We can hear you good.
Okay, thank you. So I'm also the current member of and past president of the Alaska Bankers Association. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 85, and I'll attempt to address a few of the questions that came up after my testimony here. So as Representative LeBron indicated, the Alaska Bankers Association represents six banks and one mutual bank that have operations in Alaska. And in the case of the Bankers Association, there are three state-chartered banks, one mutual bank, and then three nationally chartered banks. And all seven banks, both Alaska chartered and federally chartered, are in support of this bill. The Alaska Bankers Association, along with the four Alaska chartered banks, have submitted letters of support for the bill, which are published in your bill packet. The Bankers Association has worked for a long period of time with the State of Alaska Division of Banking and Securities to develop this proposed legislation. The provisions of the bill provide for meaningful updates to the banking code that were crafted by both Alaska banks and the Division of Banking. We are grateful to Representative LeBron and his staff for sponsoring this bill, which has come together thanks to his efforts and the efforts of the State of Alaska Division of Banking and Securities. The bill is essential to better serve our Alaskan customers, keep Alaska chartered banks competitive with other financial institutions, create parity between laws and regulations which govern the various types of financial institutions that operate in the state, keep pace with the technological advances in banking, and enable efficiency of operations. And before I end, I'd like to also posthumously thank Michael Martin. Mike was the Chief Operating Officer, General Counsel, and Corporate Secretary for North Rim Bank, and he was also the President of the Alaska Bankers Association at the time of his passing in November of last year. Mike worked for many years on these proposed changes to the banking laws, and want to publicly thank him for all of his efforts. And I also want to thank you, the committee, for your service to the state and for the opportunity to testify today. We wholeheartedly support the bill to reflect changes in technology, consumer preference, and the business of banking. And with that, I'd be happy to address questions. I was following along through the questions, so Mr. Chair, however you want to direct that part of the testimony.
Mr. Shearhorn, why don't you go ahead and if you're prepared to answer to the best of your ability, just take off and go with it, and then Senator Wilikowski will give me a signal where the gaps are.
Okay. Well, first off, there was I think this was a question that came up prior to Senator Wilikowski, and that was regarding pledging assets. I'm not sure if that was the senator's or another one. I thought it was Senator Wilson's, actually. But Representative LeBron did give an answer to that. The main reason for including this provision, as Representative LeBron indicated, was to give Alaska state-chartered financial institutions the same ability to pledge assets to secure deposits of federally recognized tribes. In the currently, nationally chartered financial institutions are able to do that, and many times this occurs when grant money is provided to federally recognized tribes, and
by the provisions of those grants, that money prior to it being spent, if it's deposited into a financial institution, needs to be secured. Under state law, currently we're not allowed to do that in state chartered financial institutions. So the idea is to provide the similar ability for state chartered financial institutions as is currently available to federally chartered institutions. And then that provides the deposits in those institutions, and then those deposits are then able to be further utilized in serving our customers. So that's the primary reason for that provision. Are there further questions regarding that issue?
No, that's good. Everybody's nodding in agreement.
Okay, thank you. And then I believe the other question from Senator Wilkowski was on Section 23. 0605265, is that correct?
Senator, yes, he's nodding yes.
Okay. And that was regarding repealing that. And as was indicated in the testimony by staff to Representative LeBon, that was being proposed to be repealed for liability of directors of certain loans, as believe that liability is covered in other areas. But to be honest, I can get back to the committee and the senator with a more specific explanation of that if that's desired.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski, we want a further little deeper dive on the answer. Joe's offered that up.
I'm just curious what the section does, what loans. So it says loans in violation of AS 0605200 through 260. I'm just curious what those loans are and what would a violation look like?
To be honest, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I would have to get back to you on the specifics on that, and I'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Shearhorn, just send those to my office and we'll distribute them to the committee.
Okay. Very good. We can do that. I believe the general intent is that liability is covered elsewhere, but we can certainly get back to you with more specifics on that.
Thank you. Further questions while we have Mr. Shearhorn on the line? Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll look forward to your little more detailed response after you've got time to noodle that and send them to our office. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Durham, Executive Vice President, Chief Credit Administrator, Mount McKinley Bank in Fairbanks. Mr. Durham, are you on the line?
Yes, Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Would you put yourself on the record and please start your testimony?
I would be happy to. Good afternoon, members of the Senate Finance Committee and co-chairs Bishop and Stedman. My name is David Durham. I am the Secretary Treasurer for the Alaska Bankers Association and the Executive Vice President, Chief Credit Administrator for Mount McKinley Bank. Bart LeBon is my predecessor. He is also my mentor, so I want to just thank him for carrying this bill for us. Mount McKinley Bank is proud to serve the communities of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, Denali Borough, and the unincorporated areas of Southeast Alaska Census Tract. Mount McKinley Bank is Alaska's only mutual bank and one of only a handful of mutual banks in the western United States. What makes mutual banks unique is that we have no owners or shareholders, and our structure lies between a commercial bank and a credit union. Our focus is providing the best financial and customer service to our local communities and not on generating dividends for shareholders. I'm proud to share with you that Mount McKinley Bank recently earned another outstanding Community Reinvestment Act rating from the FDIC, which demonstrates our commitment to serving the banking and financial needs of our local communities. Senators, it is a privilege to testify before you today regarding HB 85. HB 85 brings much-needed modernization to Alaska's banking regulations, provides parity for Alaska banks chartered under AS 06 with the national banks, but it also modernizes and gives parity to the state's only mutual bank, regulated under AS 0615. AS 0615 still has some provisions for mutual banks that were made obsolete when the savings and loans were deregulated in 1980, and HB 85 is going to help take care of that. HB 85 seeks to update the state's banking regulations to take advantage of new technology, FASB accounting standards, and level the playing field with each other. Alaska's banks have always enjoyed a friendly, competitive environment, but today our competition has grown to include numerous online financial institutions who have captured significant shares of the Alaska market. HB 85 also brings parity between commercial banks and mutual banks in the areas of lending, investing, and borrowing. HB 85 repeals AS 15.180, which restricted a mutual bank's borrowing options and allows mutual banks the same borrowing capacity as commercial banks. HB 85 also removes antiquated provisions of AS 15.150, 160, and 170, which required mutual banks to sequester up to 10% of its annual net earnings into a surplus reserve account that could only be used for meeting losses. Since the 1970s, all financial institutions have been required to reserve for losses under FASB regulations, FAS 5 and FAS 114. AS 06, 15, 150, 60, and 70 basically required that mutual banks have to duplicate their reserve requirements. HB 85 repeals these sections and brings parity with both state and national banks. Lastly, HB 85 adds provisions to AS 4603 that mirror the Federal Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, also known as CERCLA. The CERCLA regulations protect lenders from environmental liability when they must foreclose on properties that have contamination issues. CERCLA requires that lenders cannot participate in management of the property and must take reasonable steps to divest the property in the earliest practical and commercially reasonable manners to avoid liability. The CERCLA provision gives Alaska lenders the same protections afforded to lenders in other states and allows us to continue lending and investing in local businesses vital to the health of all Alaskan communities. I'd like to thank you for your time, and I request your support of HB 85, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Durham. I'm looking at the table. I don't see any questions at this point. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Rob Schmidt, Director of Alaska Division of Banking and Securities. Mr. Schmidt, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Robert Schmidt. I'm the director of the Division of Banking and Securities. The Division of Banking and Securities serves as the primary regulator for four state chartered banks in Alaska. These banks follow the Alaska banking statutes, which have become outdated over time. The nationally chartered banks have had the advantage of broader powers from updated federal laws, creating disparity between the two banking systems. There has been a collaborative effort between the Alaska Bankers Association and the Division of Banking and Securities to bridge the gap between state and federal law. House Bill 85 modernizes and streamlines Alaska's banking law to bring parity between the state and national banks and level the playing field. House Bill 85 will help our state banks to be competitive with modern best practices in the evolution of the financial services they provide. The Division of Banking and Securities supports the passage of House Bill 85. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Durham, for your testimony. Seeing no further questions, this will close our invited testimony portion of our hearing this afternoon. Next, we're going to open for public testimony. Do we have anybody online? Seeing none online, is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Any further committee discussion this afternoon before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside for this afternoon. Tomorrow, our next meeting is tomorrow, February the 1st. Tomorrow is February the 1st, 2022, at 9 a.m. on the agenda. OMB presenting the governor's 10-year fiscal plan. Senator Stedman, chairman, will be at the helm. We are gaveled out at 2:35.